Oh, hey, how are you? Great to hear. Yeah, come in. Make yourself comfortable. Like a drink? Sure. There you go. Welcome to the Tech Lounge. Shall we begin? Welcome to the Tech Lounge with me, Christian Chiller, and a FOSDEM special. FOSDEM was way back in February. I don't know. I'm doing my best to get on top of these interviews, but for some reason, they just take a while. So I'm going to pack in four interviews from FOSDEM into this episode. I should explain what FOSDEM is. It is a decades-long gathering of open source minds in Brussels. Every February, I have been, six or so times. In this last year, in February of 2025, I conducted a lot of interviews. A lot of different background noise environments. I've done my best to tidy them up as usual, but with 6,000 nerds in a university space, this is not always possible to get it perfectly right. So who do we have? There's quite a lot to pack in. First up, you're going to hear from Rebecca Rumble of the Rust Foundation, where we talk, unsurprisingly, about Rust. Next, you will hear from a variety of voices. And I will be very apologetic. I can't remember quite who was who at this point, but some combination of Damon, Gerald, and Nigel from Sysdig talking about StratoShark. Next, you will hear Frank from Nextcloud, someone who has been around in open source for quite some time. And Nextcloud is a current and long-running project in itself. And then finally, you will hear from Andy Piper, who is in charge of community at Mastodon. So really nice selection of interviews. Do put up with the background noise to listen to them. And I think, as always, before I get started, someone's got to pay for the hosting and the microphones. So just a few words from sponsors. Git is an essential tool and workflow for almost any developer in the world these days. And Git can be easy for some, but hard for others. And I've always been a fan of Git graphical tools, Git GUIs that help me and could help you understand some of those more esoteric commands or just speed up what you do on a regular basis. Tower is perhaps one of the oldest and preeminent and best known Mac and Windows Git GUIs. And if you want to get 25% off their full price tool, then head on over to go.christianchiller.com/tower.
So Rust is a relatively new programming language. It's got lots of lovely features. You know, it's really performant, it's fast, it's memory safe. And that's the thing that I think an awful lot of people kind of notice it for and sort of talk about it as a potential solution to maybe some of the legacy codes. It has been around for, officially 10 years. This is it's our 10-year birthday this year, our 10-year anniversary since the first stable release, which for some, I'm sure, feels like it's flown by, and for others feels like an absolute lifetime. So it's still relatively young. It's still developing. It's still growing, but we're in a really good spot. And the great thing about Rust is that people that have come to it love it. You know, the Stack Overflow surveys show that it's consistently one of the most loved languages. Once people have found it, they really like it, which is great. And because of those memory safe features, because sort of over the kind of past 5 years or so, I'd say lots of governments and regulators have started kind of noticing, being a lot more concerned about security. You know, the White House last year kind of published a paper suggesting that, you know, new code should be in memory safe languages by default to, you know, to avoid some of those memory issues that you get with other code bases. So it's still growing, but the trajectory is really good. And, you know, all the research shows that Rust developers are in more and more demand.
And the history, it came from Mozilla originally, am I correct?
Yeah. It was incubated inside Mozilla. So the kind of apocryphal origin story is that the author, Graydon, was... he was living on the 22nd floor of an apartment building while he was doing his comp sci degree. And the lift kept breaking down. And it was the software issue.
Oh, I thought he was going to say Rust. But there we go.
No. So this, it was the software. And obviously, you know, you don't really want to walk up 22 flights of stairs. So he you know, he was a comp sci, a very brilliant comp sci student, and he thought there's got to be a better way. So, you know, he kind of, when he was taken on at Mozilla, he was tinkering around with this. Other people in the company noticed and they were like, hey, can I, you know, that sounds cool. Can I work on that with you? And yeah, it finally got to a place where Mozilla realized that for Rust to grow and for it to flourish, it needed to be independently stewarded. Yep. You know, there's a lot of companies won't invest in a language that's solely sitting inside one organization. So they spun it out and created the foundation back in 2021.
Okay, so actually quite recent.
Very recent, yeah.
Okay, and you know, most people reaching for it are usually coming from kind of C, C++ sort of world, I guess.
Yeah, a lot of them. More and more, we're actually noticing people trying to or coming to it, not necessarily via the C or C++ route, actually, because, again, it's gaining popularity. Yeah. We've got a lot of new people coming who maybe have only used Python or Java or something before, so... it's kind of expanding outwards. Again, it was kind of designed as a back-end systems kind of language, but it's popping up everywhere now. And there's lots of, you know, there's lots of potential in safety critical space. Rust is increasingly, Python is the language of LLMs, especially like training, but Rust is increasingly kind of popping up under the hoods to make it, you know, again, faster, more performant. We find it like blockchain. Very beloved of the, blockchain
people. Not specifically on blockchain, but the sort of the fairly tight connection between Rust and WASM.
Yes.
Did they kind of come together or was it just sort of pure coincidence?
That actually, I don't know. That's a really good question. Ever since I've only been around in the Rust community for about 3.5 years. Okay. So that was already happening when I kind of toned up. So I don't know. It just seems to kind of go so well together that no one even really talks about it.
Yeah. And do you know, it's obviously in relative terms fairly modern, and you're saying solving a lot of kind of modern application issue requirements. Was that always intentional to begin with? I guess so. But what were the initial problems that the Grayson was trying to solve that just made those things come out of it?
I mean, a lot of it were the memory bugs.
Yeah.
A lot of it was just trying to make something that wasn't quite so vulnerable to individual kind of, you know, mishaps or like small mistakes. You know, the great thing about Rust is that it just won't let you compile code that's not going to work. So I think one of the big problems that it was designed to solve was like, you know, just kind of automatically cutting out individual error, which it does really well. And just, you know, memory bugs are not security, but, you know, research that Google did and they put out a year or two ago showed that, you know, just moving to Rust meant that immediately 70% of their memory bugs were gone.
I mean, it has been infamous for at least in the past, I'm assuming still now, having quite a good onboarding experience and like the compiler error messages and things like that
have traditionally
been helpful.
Yeah.
But I just sort of wonder, you know, something that is, how much work is still, you know, you can do as much, being as helpful as much as possible, but how much work is still involved to actually, you know, get it to compile? I suppose it won't let you create something bad, but there's still some work involved in getting to that point.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I think that's true of any language.
Yeah, no, for sure.
I think the project folks are amazing and they are doing, you know, everything they can to kind of move things forward so that it is as easy as possible for people just to write good code and for that to be kind of seamless and a positive experience. So they've got tons of ideas. We're always limited by how many people we actually have to work on things and how much money we can throw behind things if we need to. You know, it's the constant cry of open source, isn't it? It's like there's just never enough bodies.
Or they're all in the wrong place. It's the usual.
I mean, if you're talking
making
about
another thing that no one needs instead of helping
others. I mean, if you're talking about the compiler specifically, that's the compiler is the sexy thing to work on, right? Lots and lots of people get really excited about working on the compiler. So we've got a lot of really good quality people that are making great contributions there. Obviously, you know, it's other, like documentation is so important. But again, much less sexy. People are much less excited about
doing documentation.
So yeah, I mean, those are the things that hold us back. There will always be more work to do. I think, yeah. You know, the great thing about the Rust project and the community that I really love is that there's a kind of shared ethos that we're not just going to be good enough. We're going to be as good as we can be, you know, just because this is fine. Can we be better? And that kind of goes across everything, not just the code they write, but how they behave as a community. So that's a really nice thing.
One thing that's always intrigued me with Rust, though, is, you know, a lot of languages, like Python has the snake and the eggs and all sorts of other things. Rust has been slightly confusing because you have Rust, cargo, a crab. Like, I've never really entirely understood what the connection between all those is.
I honestly don't know myself. Okay. I mean, Ferris the crab came along years ago and it's just beloved by the community now, right? So, and that's obviously, you know, Rustation. They will call themselves Rustations. But yeah, I think you'd have to probably ask someone like that was around 10, 15 years ago where that came from.
Fair enough. Yep. And what, there have been other languages that have emerged in the past few years. I say this and I'm trying to actually think of examples, but anyway, that have sort of promised new things that people needed, et cetera, and maybe they weren't as successful. So what do you think were the recipes for success with Rust in the past few years, especially?
I mean, the early adoption of Rust by some of the big tech companies helped us kind of supercharge adoption and demonstrate pretty quickly how, you know, useful Rust can be, how productive Rust can be. The fact that we managed to get, when we founded as a foundation, you know, we managed to get like 5 founding members who are all very big tech organizations.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
That helped, you know, that. I think languages can struggle in the early days if there's not a really good, strong plurality of players.
Yeah.
And I think it makes other people nervous to invest or adopt if they think it's really only being controlled, however light touch, by one company or two companies.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas we had very luckily, because people recognized the potential, we had a really strong group of people right from the get-go, organizations right from the get-go that, you know, were very publicly committed. And, you know, when they hired me, I'm the first permanent executive director of the foundation. I think the board was still trying to figure out what they had, you know, they knew Rust had potential, but you know, when they brought me on board, they basically allowed me to not do whatever I want, but you know, they gave me full kind of autonomy to kind of go and push it in the world and engage with policymakers and audiences that maybe they hadn't had the time as volunteers to engage with. So I've spent the last kind of three and a half years trying to make sure that Rust is prominent and noticed as well.
And so what is the kind of the intention of the foundation? A lot of open source projects have foundations and some work in different sorts of ways. So.
Totally. I can remember when I came on board, I kind of looked at other foundations, like what's the module?
Yeah.
And there isn't really one.
Some are very commercial and some aren't. And
yeah. No two foundations are the same, which was really interesting to me. You know, our job, our bylaws, you know, name us as the steward of the language. So we exist to make sure that the language is sustainable, that it's well-funded, that it's well-loved, and that, you know, most importantly, the community that build it are able to do that without having to worry about, you know, all of the boring stuff that I do. You know, we, as the foundation, we are very kind of hands-off in terms of the direction of the language, but we obviously are here to advocate for the users of the language and the adopters of the language as well. So, you know, we work very, very closely with the project. We make sure, obviously, that we're providing all of that kind of backroom
infrastructure. So the project and the foundation are not kind of completely connected. Like, what's the relationship there?
It's weird. It's weird because it's open source.
No, for sure.
So basically, we have, so on our board, we have all of the member directors that, you know, pay to play. The companies, but we have 5 seats reserved for people from the Rust project.
Okay.
So they are people that'll be probably in one or other
team.
So
there is some kind of connection. Not
yeah,
just like,
absolutely.
Like, oh, we're the foundation. The project are like...
No, we're very, very close. And I'm really pleased that on the board itself, you know, if there is a vote, an important vote, we have to have kind of a supermajority vote. Okay. So the members can never outvote the project people. There has to be a balance. So that's great. So we work with them, obviously, at that kind of top-down level. But, I mean, on a day-to-day basis, all of our engineers pretty much are in contact with different people inside the project as well to help them out. Because we want to, you know, as the foundation, we want to provide the kind of, obviously, the infrastructure and, you know, just like hosting crates and that kind of thing. You know, we have to keep the lights on so that people can use the language. But we also want to make sure that we are filling the gaps that are really important to keeping the language current and well-regarded. So, you know, security is not really something that you should leave to a volunteer.
And there's a whole bunch of governance around that kind of stuff. Like governance. Package managers are, in theory, responsible for certain things, increasingly so these days.
So we want to provide all that, and we want to do it in a way that, you know, respects and honors the project and not make decisions without the project that will affect them. So, it's all of those things to make sure that Rust is as good as it can be without burdening people that are doing, like, you know, let's face it, the really good work that they are expert at. And, yeah, as you say, increasingly we're talking about governance, we're talking about restrictions, you know, making sure that we're on the right side of sanctions and all of this other stuff that, you know, requires lawyers coming to Brussels.
An authority to be sued, and stuff like that, unfortunately. It's something that often comes up. You know, as soon as companies start using your open source project, suddenly you are liable for things even if you didn't want to be, didn't realize.
Well, yeah, so, all of a sudden, we are an open source steward as of, you know, when the CRA came in. Yeah. So that's a new thing that now we have to make sure that we're complying with.
All right, well, more fun things. So we're at FOSDEM, and I think it was not really an announcement, but there was a big presentation on the fact that there's now more Rust in the Linux core, which has got a lot of people excited for various different reasons. Is there anything, apart from that one, so I think that one has been discussed a fair bit, and I don't really know enough detail anyway, but is there any other kind of areas that you're particularly proud of at the moment that Rust is finding its way into that maybe people do know or don't know as much?
Sure. I mean, one of the big things that we're investing in at the moment with support from Google, actually, is Rust and C++ interop.
Okay.
You know, there have been some people
like with Kotlin and Java from that kind of
I mean, there's been some people on the internet who have opinions, and they say, rewrite it in Rust. And I'd like to state that no one from the Rust Foundation or the Rust Project would ever really say that. You know, we are realists.
Yes.
C++ code is not going anywhere, but it can be potentially made safer. You know, you can, you know, make some lovely wrappings, rusty wrappings for C++ code to make it a bit more safe. There are numerous other points where, you know, better interoperability between Rust and C++ is good for everyone. It's good for Rust community. It's good for the C++ community. Ultimately, you know, this kind of work is good for the end consumer. You know, my old dad, when he's like using internet banking or whatever.
Exactly.
Like, it's easy to kind of lose sight of the work that we do, like actually affecting a real person down the line. But, you know, that's, I think, a really positive piece of work. And, you know, we've put a lot of effort into speaking with the C++ community. So, yeah, our lead on that, John Bowman, is doing a lot of work trying to figure out how best to kind of unify approaches to unrest interrupt. So that's really exciting. And, you know, we continue, like, to do some really cool stuff in security. We're, again, working with other language foundations and other organizations like OpenSSF. So that, you know, a lot of security threats are kind of similar across kind of foundations and languages. So that kind of collaboration, I think, is really exciting, because some people try to kind of, you know, make it a competitive zero-sum game. Oh, it's Rust or it's Python or this is better than that. But we really like working together, and it's great to only invent the wheel once and be able to kind of replicate good practice. So that's really cool as well.
Spoken to Sysdig a little bit before, I think we talked mostly about Sidekick, but maybe let's do a very, very quick recap of Sysdig, Valco, the history of the company very quickly first, just to recap.
Well, I mean, Sysdig, the company, was founded, I forgot what, around 2015 by Loris Dejani. He Loris and I had worked together previously at a company called Case Technologies, which had been acquired by Riverbed. And, you know, we had a case, we built products that complemented Wireshark and, you know, kind of built up this really, you know, good business, just, you know, helping people to, you know, gather up network packets and inspect them and analyze them. And Loris had the bright idea of adapting that and analyzing system calls. If you look at the system call layer, you know, that sits between programs that run on an operating system and the operating system itself, you kind of have this thing that, well, if you tilt your head and squint just right, it looks kind of like a network segment, because there's all this interesting thing that's stuff that's happening, and anything relevant happening on the operating system has to go through that layer. So if you can tap into that and pull system calls out, then you have some really a really rich source of information to you know, analyze the behavior of a system and its characteristics and make it, you know, faster and more reliable and more secure.
Yeah.
And so, you know, Loris founded Sysdig, and I don't know if you want to throw anything else in about the company. But
Yeah, I think then it's just this like continuous evolution of the projects. Like we were saying that with Wireshark, you had the libpcap library, and then how that's mirrored in every way the design of the libscap library. So Sysdig, the technology for monitoring system calls, it has more or less a similar approach for capture and inspection of system calls as what you'd expect, even down to the file names, right? Where you have PCAP file versus an SCAP file. Now, Falco evolved from Sysdig. It uses the same libpcap and their libscap and the libs inspection library, but it used it for a different use case. So yes, of course, it's monitoring system calls, but the difference here is that it's saying, if I can stick a rule logic on top of it that you're familiar with, then I can detect threats. Yep. Whereas until this point, the two technologies we've been talking about are very much forensics. We're monitoring everything for the purpose of troubleshooting, or it could be security related.
Yep.
But with Falco, it just becomes purely a detection use case.
Yep.
And then Stratoshark is even here an evolution again. We're using the same libraries through, except I guess you're forking context from Wireshark as well.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah, so it's really all of the technologies are now kind of met in the crossroad where we have Stratoshark today.
So hang on, so the mesh is Stratoshark?
So with Stratoshark, and I think sometimes it's easier just to visually show it. So if my Wireshark opens up correctly, maybe I'll close it first. Yeah, I'll give that a second.
But got to start from a known good state.
Yeah, exactly. But no, we were running a bunch of different captures earlier today, and I think the familiarity here between Wireshark and Stratoshark is evidently clear from the visual representation. Now I'm using some unusual filter, but if, let's say, I show everything. Oh, no, this is a dead file. Let's never mind that one. But let's say I go for this Nginx record example. You can see, like, this is only like a 15 or even 10 second capture. You can see there's like over a million events that it's clocking up.
Recap
here.
A couple of things. The SCAP file is a capture of.
It's from Sysdig libraries.
Okay. And then, so the point of Stratoshark is from memory of what I read, it's a visualizer and an analysis tool. Yeah.
Like I would see it as a utility. Is that the best way of describing it? Because do you know, with all of these CLI tools, you go into the terminal and you can run all sorts of arbitrary queries, and things come and they happen and they work. But the difference here is you've got this tool that's quite literally running on my desktop, whether it's MacBook, Windows, or on a Linux machine. You have this utility, and then from there you can choose how you're going to send the system calls to it, or if you collect the PSCAP file somewhere else, you can open up here. And it's effectively a troubleshooting GUI. You know, I have my hexadecimal output here, I have all my system call context here for a single moment in time, and then you can filter it to look for, again, something on the lines of an outbound connection, and then this will filter it down accordingly and prettify it in a way that you get a color-coordinated view of everything.
And so you're saying you could open a file, but you could also have something, I don't know, streaming to this, whatever the...
Yeah,
methodology.
So that's actually a really good point there to go to. So there's the CloudTrail plugin today where you can straight, you know, you can point to an S3 bucket or an SNSQ, and you can get the the audit logs from the cloud provider. But then you also have SSH dig, correct? Do you want to talk to that?
SSH dig.
Yeah, sure. It's just another version of,
Well, on the Wireshark side, you know, again, we're coming back to the mirroring. Wireshark for a very long time has had a utility called SSH dump, and it uses a library called libssh to make it a connection to a remote machine, run either TCP dump or dumpcap, which is what ships with Wireshark, you know, whatever capture utility, and just stream back PCAP data or PCAP NG data over that connection to your local instance of Wireshark. And SSH dig does the same thing on the sysdig side. It runs sysdig remotely and streams that data back.
Okay. And this is purely a desktop application? Yeah, so at the moment, yeah, it's a purely a desktop. I think where you're thinking of is, say, I had a terminal open earlier and, okay, wow, that looks really hard to read. But if that session is still active, in fact, I'll just close and open a new one. But like, say, imagine, let's say you have a Kubernetes cluster. Mm. So I'm going to open up a new window. And from here, let's say CD into my desktop. And on here, I have my SSH key. So I'm just going to log into that server. And granted, okay, there's no internet issues. So if I said kubectl get pods, you know, you can see that this is clearly a Kubernetes cluster that I'm running in. But the actual tool sysdig, it's not running as a pod inside the cluster. It's actually just like a process that's running on its own. Yeah. So like you can run sudo, in this case sysdig, and you can see quite literally all the system calls that are happening in real time. So when we want to capture the file you were mentioning there a second ago, what I would just do is something like sudo sysdig dash w, similar to the way you do in TCP dump or T-shark, and write to the file, which we can call test 10.scap, let's say. Yeah. And then you give it, well, in my case, I like to do a timeout. So let's say timeout for 5 seconds. And in this case, I've got a 5 second countdown, 5 second capture. And that will cover, that will collect quite literally everything. There was no scope, there's no filter for that. Yeah. So when we check ls, you know, we have the new file test 10.scap. So if I wanted to hypothetically, well, not hypothetically, let's do it. If we wanted to move that to my local desktop, we can then type in test 10.scap. This will then be on my local desktop. Again, it's moving, it's 25, much smaller than the capture I tried moving earlier, which was enormous. So this one will give a few more seconds and I'll have it on my desktop. So you can see that I very much did that on in user space, but there is actually the actual driver in this case is still collecting from the kernel directly.
Yeah.
So if I was to go back into StratoShark, I can then go file, open test 10.scap, which is the file just captured. And naturally, I'm just going to...
I think the question was more like, I mean, I love desktop applications.
Yeah.
But it's not really what most people tend to make anymore. It tends to be cloud, web-based things and stuff like that. So I sort of wondered, what was why make a desktop tool for this?
StratoShark leverages Wireshark's code base. I mean, we literally just split the UI code and you know, formed this separate application. You know, I called the process.
It's relatively easy.
Well, conceptually, it was pretty easy. Yeah. In the same way that conceptually mitosis makes sense, but at the same time, once you actually try to do that within the cell, it gets really hairy. But you know, Wireshark is an existing desktop application. It always has been. If somebody wanted to make a cloud version of this, you know, they certainly could, but you know, that's just, you know, the code that we had, and it was the workflow that our users are used to and what they make use of. You know, I don't, this might be useful online, but that's not what we're focusing on right now. And if it's something the users ask for, that's certainly something we're going to look at.
Yeah. This is mostly for a tool for developers and DevOps people working with various cloud connected things to be able to just analyze stuff in a more, I would say, comfortable environment.
Okay. And I think, at least personally, there's an advantage to having this desktop application because, especially on the Wireshark side, if your network's down, you can't access a cloud server to go analyze your network.
Exactly. Yeah. That's one of the problems with the cloud is people sometimes forget is you can't always access it. But does Sysdig have a commercial tool that looks a bit like this? Is that sort
it's
of
funny? There's a lot of tools with the name Sysdig in it. Yeah. So here's Sysdig, the two we just showed there, the CLI is the best way of describing it, the pseudo Sysdig. Then there's Sysdig, well, there's C-Sysdig, which is, gives you the statistics view of it, and there's chisels associated with that. Then there's Sysdig Inspect, which is the visual representation.
It's probably the most comparable, I guess.
So in the Sysdig Secure, which is the platform, which nowadays has been rebranded to Sysdig, which gets more confusing, I know. But in that platform, there is this managed implementation of Falco and Sysdig Inspect and C-Sister or Sysdig, sorry, the CLI. So the use case here is if I detect something in Falco under the hood, you know, they're the detection rules, and you can take response actions. Now, one could be something like kill a process, but another could be, could you capture me a 10-second, 15-second capture, but also start with the capture context of 5 seconds before the incident. That way you kind of see what is happening. And I don't think it's 5 seconds before, it might even be only 3 seconds before, but it's, you get all that kind of surrounding capture in response to a security incident. Okay.
Now, I love desktop applications, but I look at this and I can see it doesn't look, is it cute? Is it, what did you build this in?
It's cute.
It's cute. Yeah. Okay. It has that slight look. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's, we're, that's, you know, one of the, I guess one of the things you have to deal with when you're developing a cross-platform application is what approach you take. I mean, you know, the modern approach is to use
Electron.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I mean, that's the popular way of doing it nowadays. Yeah. But you know, when we're developing this Electron, especially early on, Electron either didn't exist or it was just too new. Yeah. And I've been happy with Qt so far. I mean, it's not perfectly native everywhere, but it's native enough.
Yeah, and there's plenty of like high performance tools that use it, like Open Broadcast Studio, which does video streaming. I mean, it's pretty intense. Apparently, I don't know if it still is, but apparently Ableton Live was made in Qt at some point. I don't think it still is, I'm not sure. But you can do some quite interesting things with it.
So. Yeah, and Qt has a stander on here too, so I'm sure they'd be able to rattle off all the other applications. Mm-hmm. But
I've been working on
a
Nokia piece recently, so I've been digging into Qt. Okay, and it's open source as well, I assume.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. The motivation to make this in the first place? What was the itch that someone was trying to scratch?
Well, the sort of half joke line, half truth line is that I've been giving out is that, you know, Loris invited me over to his house one day and said, you know, we got out a big sheet of paper and started drawing on it and eventually came up with the original concept for this. So, a couple of years ago. Okay. If you, during the talk, there was a slide with that, you know, showed the libpcap ecosystem and all the applications that are part of that. And later on, we showed the SCAP ecosystem, and you have, you know, the Sysdig command line tool, and you have Falco. And there was kind of a hole there because, you know, you had this, you know, an IDS-like tool that you know, served that particular need, and you had a little command line tool. I won't say little, but because it's actually very featureful. But you didn't have this desktop interactive deep analysis tool, you know, that let you drill down and do all this stuff that you typically would do with Wireshark on the network side. And that's the role that StarterShark is filling.
Mm-hmm. Actually, I did go back a step because forgive me for not necessarily knowing the internals of SCAP files, but so all of this is just a visualization of what's in the file. There's nothing else coming here. It's just sort of pulling out the content and displaying in different ways. There's nothing else happening. It's more like a parsing of the file sort of thing.
Yeah, that's one way of putting it. But I think it's also like that standard approach that we're all familiar with within Wireshark.
Yeah.
So let's say, for instance, I want to look at all... Now, this capture was the test 10. We'll pick a different example, one that I know there's something quite interesting in. Let's say this crash loop back off.
Mm-hmm.
So I open this. And in here, obviously, there's a bunch of these pre-filtered searches that you can use. Now, if I was to... Is this the same one from earlier that was breaking? Oh, do you know what? It's actually just a huge file.
Pretty big,
Yeah, so I think that was the one I recorded earlier. I could give it a few more seconds. In fact, I will, just because it's nearly done.
Yeah.
But let's say when that finishes, now we'll have everything.
Yeah.
So if I was to go down to all commands that were executed against just anything that matches that event type effect CVE, now I have all this activity. Let's say I should be able to say, and process name is set to kubectl and must be some example of something I ran there earlier with kubectl, hopefully. But the reason I say this is, let's say there's a bunch of different tools today in the ecosystem. Tetragon comes to mind, that they're looking at being a tool that can monitor system calls, but it's really designed with the context of Kubernetes in mind. And then Sysdig CLI, like that we ran there a while ago, yes, it can return all that stuff in the form of an SCAP, but as far as like querying and the search filter go, it's not the same experience the users are familiar with in Wireshark. And I think having that now, there actually wasn't anything for kubectl specifically, but let's go back and hit enter. My point being here is you get that same experience where you can use like same value attributes when you're doing the filter. Okay. But then also, like, I mean, Gerald's showing me the shortcut earlier, but let's say if there's, you want to look at everything that has execute permission set to false, you could actually just drag or drop that value into the search view. Yeah. And then when you say, oh, it's selected, and then it will, of course, do the search for it. So it's just a different experience than what you would have if you were doing everything on the command line.
What's some of these other, like the statistics?
Yeah, do you want to talk to those, Gerald?
Sure.
Let
me see if I can. No, let's see what's under there.
Okay.
There's not a lot there.
Yeah.
No.
This is intriguing.
As I said in my talk, this is a weird mix of a fully mature application, which is, you know, what the Wireshark code gives you, and this sort of greenfield open space, which is going to allow us to add, you know, better and more specific analysis features as time goes on. But if I, you know, I don't know if this is going to show us anything, but yeah, if I go down to like a container IO, I can see a report with all the IO for each application and each connection, each file descriptor actually.
Yeah.
You know, things like that. And this is just something we threw in. I mean, it's a useful view, but at the same time, I can't wait to see what our user community comes up with and suggests and implements. One of the long running things about Wireshark that I love is that every once in a while somebody comes up with this great idea and implements it, and suddenly we have this great new feature like following a TCP stream and seeing the contents of that stream. And in fact, we can follow the contents of a file descriptor stream in StratoShark. You know, that was a feature that somebody just contributed out of the blue one day, though. It's one of the coolest features in Wireshark. And I'm really looking forward to that happening with StratoShark as well.
Okay. So, I mean, it's relatively new, but I'm sort of with the community projects, but still, I can ask the question, what's next?
In the immediate term, I mean, there's a lot of work to do to, you know, fill in some really obvious gaps, like, you know, we don't have local system call capture for Mac OS or Windows. I don't know when that's going to come about, but, you know, that's a very natural thing to have happen.
Interesting, yeah, because default consoles are...
You know, there's probably some workflow improvements and user experience improvements to be made with capture. I mean, SSHDig only lets you save one configuration right now, and we need to let people save multiple, because obviously you're not going to just SSH into one machine. You know, little things like that. You know, there are a lot of little features like that that I want to get implemented, you know, as soon as possible, just so that it gets immediately more useful to users.
Yep. Okay. Anything else? It's available now.
Yeah.
I think the one thing that's worth pointing out there is just while we're in this early stage is stratoshark.org.
Yeah.
So you can tell, like, this kind of what we're trying to do is have a page where you have just about everything you need to get started. So one of the questions came up earlier was, do you have the installers for the different distributions? I didn't even actually mention that in the slides. But it makes sense, right? It's that we want to make sure that we have an installer for every support environment.
Do you have a homebrew for me?
We do. Correct me if I'm wrong, or is that what? Homebrew?
Yes.
They
caught me by surprise because they implemented, I don't know who there noticed that there was a StratoShark installer, but man, they latched onto that.
Easy to make right here.
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
This is one of those like nuanced things that we noticed, that like Falk or Sysdig, the CLI tool, has been around since 2015.
Yeah.
But as the love and attention started going further and further towards Falco, we realized that there was like not a lot of public facing documentation on basic things like what is the SCAP format and how do you write those files. So we kind of took in a short amount of time
push to
the content on, say, Medium to explain what is it, how can you use the tool to capture, and then basically go through that process of how to get the context that you're going to then use in StrataShare.
Yeah.
Because until we have like fully fleshed out docs, I think we are in one of those kind of fun spots now where people in the community, like in the case of Josh Clark here, explaining kind of in their own personal documentation how to use the technology. And to your point as well, like I think those who are taking an interest in system calls and are doing, let's say, process monitoring as opposed to packet capture analysis, they're going to be the ones posing the functionality, like should we have this knob or whistle that's going to be for this specific use case.
When I was telling you earlier about the thing I was trying to use Wireshark for, now I'm starting to think maybe I was using the wrong tool and this actually is more
Do you want to explain that?
I will in a second. I actually saw this really good talk it was actually a Grammarly. They have a big development team in Berlin and they have tech meetups every now and then. And they had one from the macOS development team. And I've always found their macOS application to be okay. And then after seeing the level of detail this guy was going to, I was like, okay, I think I like your application better. Because he was going like, so he was showing you all these like Objective-C tools you could get to dig into like deserialized binaries of private Apple frameworks. So they were trying to figure out how to implement something and they couldn't figure it out. And it's like, well, this application kind of does it. And there's this like digging and digging all these processes and seeing what they were passing with each other. I was just like, this guy can really take you some interesting places sometimes. Just so people could copy and paste text from one application to another and it wouldn't break, basically. It was kind of incredible, this tool.
Yeah.
So there we go.
Yeah.
Cool. All right.
Yeah. I was going to say that the SCAP file format, that's kind of another story that we haven't really told yet, which is, you know, back at Case Technologies, one of the things that we did with alongside the community was develop the PCAP-NG format. You know, it was apparent that, you know, PCAP is a great format, but it's very simple and that format is stable and you can't really add anything to it. And so, you know, we kind of came up with PCAP-NG around that time to let you add information, you know, more information than just packet data to those files. And we kind of ended up designing a universal logging format and SCAP files. SCAP files are just modified. Well, I won't say modified. They're just a special version of PCAP-NG. I mean, it's the same file header and you have just have different block types. But when I say universal logging format, I mean, really universal. Mike Kershaw, the guy who wrote Kismet, did he add geolocation data? Anyway, somebody added geolocation data. I know Mike Kershaw has been working recently on adding radiological data, like stuff from Geiger counters, that, you know, as you drive through and capture, say, wireless information with Kismet, you can pull in.
So using something that was designed infrastructure, but for.
But that format has grown to add so much more data that the community has contributed that you just never would have thought of.
Yeah.
I mean, I never would have thought that it would be useful. I mean, it'd be interesting, but to pull in, you know, radioactivity data.
I know, of course. And yet it's a strong use case.
Yeah.
In that isolated field,
And then you have a visualization tool.
Yeah. Well, sort of. of course.
Cool. Okay. Awesome. Thank you very much, then.
One of my most popular videos is an old one now on Mermaid, the markup language that lets you create diagrams, flowcharts, and all sorts of other things using a markup language. So you can mix it with Markdown, LaTeX, ASCII-Doc, etc. It's used in a lot of static sites and documentation, and a lot of people like it because you can basically version images. Mermaid is open source and free, but some of the maintainers behind it have now created a new company called Mermaid Chart that turns Mermaid into a commercial enterprise tool with team features, more visual interface, AI diagrams, infinite canvas, whiteboard, all sorts of other cool features. Now, if you're interested in finding out more, I have a link you can follow to get a discount off a paid plan. And of course, earn a little bit for the show. head on over to go.christianchiller.com/mermaidchart.
Feels like Nextcloud is another one of those kind of projects that is fairly well known, but maybe we should have just a quick overview as to what it is.
Yeah, so Nextcloud is, Gartner calls it a content collaboration platform.
Okay.
So it's really a tool for working together between people over the internet. It's very comparable to Microsoft 365, Google Workspace, Slack, Zoom, Dropbox, all these collaboration tools. The difference with Nextcloud is, of course, that it's 100% open source, and you can really run it and deploy it and use it as you want. All these other competitors are all software as a service, and we're the only ones that can really be installed and deployed how you want and as you want it.
So how does one turn that into a business? I think your biggest competition is always yourself, because people can just do it themselves. But then the sorts of companies I assume you'd need to get on board to make it a business, convincing them to use something that isn't one of the big competitors is also probably a challenge. So how have you managed to do that?
That's a very good question. I mean, that's the thing I'm doing all the time, thinking about how to make this work. So, I mean, there are lots and lots of things that are needed. So first of all, you need to have a product that is interesting for the community, but also for businesses. Because if it's not interesting for the community, you cannot really build a community, you don't get contributors, you don't get like grassroots marketing, all the things you need. But of course, at the end of the day, you want to sell to bigger organizations, not to home users. So you need to have that in the first place. And then you said it yourself, that the competition is ourselves. That's true. It's not here, it's from our salespeople. That in sales conversations, you usually don't need to convince them that Nextcloud is good. They already know it. They already like it. This is why they're contacting us. But that they should buy our support subscription.
Yeah.
So we need to, because obviously we cannot want to sell the software, it's open source, free software, but we need something else to sell, and this is the support subscription. It's basically a bunch of things around Nextcloud that you want to have if you run it in a professional way, which is support, certifications, trainings, help with security, help with scalability, stuff like that.
And is that... that's all you sell? There's no kind of open core extra features kind of thing? It's just purely the...
Yeah. This is part of the principles that we gave ourselves when Nextcloud was founded, between 12 people, that we don't want to do open core. We want to be 100% open source. So the software is, 100% open.
Okay. Maybe I missed it in the list you just said there, but do you also offer like hosted options, or is it purely support?
No, we don't host it ourselves. We want to be just an organization that uses the software. We have lots and lots of partner companies who do hosting. And so if you want to have a hosted Nextcloud, there are lots of options, but we don't do it. Also, because I don't want to have a central instance.
Okay,
it's all about decentralization. Yes.
I ran it on a Raspberry Pi for a fair amount of time. So
Nice.
And so who are the kind of sectors, customers that... Yeah. Not even necessarily even paying, but just like big users, shall
yeah.
I say.
Yeah, this is really funny, because at the beginning I thought, companies were probably very interested in Nextcloud, like businesses, and organizations like schools, universities are very slow, governments is very slow. I really thought that we will sell a lot to companies, and actually the opposite is true. Our main customers are government organizations, cities, and also schools and universities.
Okay.
I would say these are the biggest sectors. It's a bit of a surprise.
It's been a long time since I went to university, and I'm trying to remember. I don't remember what we used. But I think I had a Unix login, which kind of dates it. So, I don't know. Okay. And are they mostly in Europe, or are they also in other places?
All over the world. Okay. All over the world. But mostly to organizations who really care about security and privacy and compliance. So there's a lot in Europe, because in Europe a lot of people are a bit paranoid, rightfully so, regarding security, GDPR and so on, for example, but also other organizations. Like whenever you have something special to protect, you don't want to give it into the public cloud, then the Nextcloud is used.
Okay. How did you get here with Nextcloud? I think say about 12 years ago, I feel like there was things that came a little before and stuff, but like, firstly, why start this in the first place?
Mm.
We mentioned when we were walking here, I think some of the experiences working in similar places, but yeah, it's you know, it's a market that is fairly sewn up by some big players, different big players then than now, but it's a tough one to think of entering. So your why and how.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I was always an idealist, and I was thinking about like what IT can do to contribute to the world. And it was like, well, 15 years ago now, long time ago, when it became obvious that a lot of IT that was classic was before like on our computers is moving to the cloud. So you have suddenly had like Gmail, your mails are in the browser, and Dropbox, your files are in the cloud and the browser. And basically it was clear that we move into a world where like 5-6 big companies that control everything in IT. They have all the data, they have all the communication, and I thought this is not a good thing. So it basically the idea was to have a decentralized local open source alternative to this one. So I mean, it's, I don't know, I think having everything as software as a service is compelling, but there will always be people who don't want that for lots of reasons. Yeah. Security reasons, performance reasons, price reasons, flexibility reasons, I don't know. And yeah, this is what we have a solution for.
Okay. And then, yeah, but what was the development story? Was it a long-term thing? Was it something that kind of came together from some pre-assembled bits and pieces and has developed over time? It feels like something like this would have been a reasonably big undertaking, like right in the early days.
It's interesting. If you look at from where Nextcloud is today, of course, it looks like it's a huge project, super complex, very powerful. But of course, everything starts small.
Yeah.
So I was invited to give a keynote at a conference in San Diego at the time. And I thought, I need to have something interesting to say. And this was like 2 months before this conference. And I thought, this was over Christmas. And then I just thought, okay, well, I have this idea of this software. And I just sat down and just wrote it. Wrote the first version, the 1.0 myself over the Christmas holidays. And yeah, of course, it was not comparable to what it is today, but it was a start. The basic features were there. And obviously, I released it as open source, and immediately people looked at it and contributed to it, and it just growing. And yeah, this is where we are today.
From what I remember, for the most part, it's PHP still? Or?
Yeah, there's still a lot of PHP there, but nowadays it's quite modular.
Yeah.
We have also Python components. We have the AI stuff we do is in Python mostly.
Yeah.
Then we have Go and Rust components. We have Node.js components, so it's quite modular nowadays. Yeah.
And just how, you know, 15 years ago, I feel like in terms of collaboration tools, people sort of expected things a certain way.
Mm.
I can't even remember what they might have been, but it was maybe more less in the browser and maybe more in applications and with some sort of file sync and stuff like that. And now people sort of expect something slightly different. So there's a lot more just done in the browser and things like that. But you also mentioned that sort of cloud-based was your initial idea. Were you kind of maybe, has how Nextcloud has functioned changed over time? Or are you a little bit more ahead and have always been a little more what people are expecting now?
So the idea of Nextcloud always was that it should be fit into lots of different scenarios and use cases. So the very first version 1.0 already had a web interface where you can manage your files, but at the same time also had a WebDAV interface where you can just mount it as a network drive. We didn't have mobile apps at the time yet, but nowadays we also have native mobile apps. And you can use it online, offline, browser, phone, tablet, everything. So the idea is that it's really broad, and this was always the idea.
Okay. This, you know, a lot of the, I think there's the Nextcloud is something that has a lot of, whatever you call it, plugins, you know, third-party components. So how much in a, I think firstly, how many features are in core, I guess, is that people might expect? Just if you just install it, quote unquote, by default, whatever that may mean, what do you get?
The thing is, if you install it by default, it already comes with like about 30 apps or plugins shipped and enabled by default.
And are they mostly developed by Nextcloud or are they a bit of a mix?
Yeah, partly. I mean, the really core, this is where Nextcloud paid developers do the most work, but there are also lots of components come from community contributors. And so if you really install the Nextcloud and you switch off every app, all the apps, then really not a lot is left. So it's very, very modular.
Okay.
This was the idea from the first place. By the way, it's also a reason that this is called apps and not plugins.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Because
apps
it's
is the right, yeah.
No.
It's overused is a word these days.
That's true, unfortunately. Yeah. But the reason is that it is that they're not extensions. They're like full applications running on top of a software stack.
Yeah.
So because if you think a plugin, you think, oh, it's adding a button here or there. But we really have like, I don't know, financial management software running on top. We have chat, video conferencing, calendar, all the stuff is real applications on top.
Yeah,
this is why it's.
How do you? Because there's always this problem with kind of maintaining third-party ecosystem stores, whatever you want to call it, where things, especially in an open-source world, they can come in and out with maintenance.
Yeah,
and potentially people are looking for something, and it's something they will find. And I would say a calendar tool of some description, and it hasn't really been maintained for a while.
Yeah,
and maybe it doesn't work anymore, or there's some issue with it. How is there? Does Nextcloud itself go through a process of trying to ensure that at least popular plugins still work, or?
That's a very good question.
Yeah.
I mean, Nextcloud is a company and it's also a community, right? And as a company, we have, I pay some developers and those developers that can say, hey, can you fix this bug or like maintain this app? And we're trying to do our best to keep the most important ones like working and stable. But the ecosystem is so big nowadays that there are, of course, lots of apps that are done by someone. And it is like, as you described, some are just not compatible anymore. And we're trying to help the community as much as possible with documentation tools. And we have our conference where we fly them in and bring them together. So we're trying to have a nice and healthy community and that all the apps and all the bugs are fixed. But it's impossible to do everything.
Yeah, I think this is a leading question because I feel like last time I looked, I hit one of the, I can't remember what it was, and it was kind of annoying. It's sort of like, this thing you thought, I can't even remember what it was, to be honest with you. I don't know.
It's probably
something to do with a calendar.
It's of course a problem, but it's still relatively good in the open source world because if someone drops it and have other priorities in life and doesn't maintain it anymore, someone else can pick it up and fix it again. Yeah. If this would be proprietary software by a company, then it would just die and disappear.
No, and Apple App Store and things are full of just as many abandoned products.
Yeah.
So, and you can't do much about those.
You cannot fix them.
Exactly. And often you have to pay for them to discover that there's a problem as well. And in that, are there any restrictions on how other people can run businesses within the Nextcloud sort of ecosystem? Or is it fairly free? Someone also wants to charge for their thing, but it has to be open.
There are no restrictions beside what the AGPL license is, right? So you cannot really take it and turn it into a proprietary software. That's not allowed.
Okay.
But beside that, you can do what you want to.
So if I was Microsoft, for example, and really wanted to have Word bridge. I don't know. I could?
You could. They could. Yeah. I mean, there are some examples where some big tech companies picked up open source and components or products and turned it into their own thing. It could happen with Nextcloud, theoretically. Yeah.
Okay.
Hopefully not. But.
No, I just sort of wondered. Like, it's unlikely because they probably want to do their business elsewhere. But because I think there's one, I feel like I've heard there's one particular component of, is it Collabra or something in Nextcloud, where it's often one of the big things that people install alongside. And I don't know if that is a business in itself or not.
Called Collabra Online. It's an office component.
Yeah.
So if you want to edit your office documents in Nextcloud, then this is the recommended way to do it. And this is done by a company called Collabra, but they're building it on top of LibreOffice.
Okay.
Yeah.
So yeah,
it's quite an important but also big and complex component.
I feel like I did attempt to, and maybe my Raspberry Pi wasn't good enough, so I can't remember. So you already mentioned the dreaded two-letter AI word in that, somewhere in there.
Yeah.
But I'm assuming that's one of them, but in general, what are some of the sort of newer features and functionality that Nextcloud added recently?
Oh, wow. Let me think about it. There's so much. We are trying to do more and more with end-to-end encryption.
Okay.
For example, in the past, we only could do encrypt and decrypt files in the clients. So the desktop sync client and the mobile clients, they can decrypt and encrypt the files, so end-to-end encrypted, as the name says. But it means on the server and the web interface, you cannot really do anything with the files anymore. They're encrypted. With the new version, we're also adding support for end-to-end encryption to the web interface.
Okay.
So in the first, in the next version, only read-only, and the next version after that also read-write. So this is a very heavily requested feature. So this is coming. There is in the web interface, there's write-to-left support for write-to-left languages.
Okay, interesting. Yeah,
this was a huge work actually done by a community person. This was very, very impressive. We're also introducing end-to-end encrypted video calls now.
Okay.
Yeah, there's a lot in this.
So that the kind of the communication aspect was something that Nextcloud didn't have before.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the chat and video conferencing, that's something that's relatively new.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is also, I think, where the world is going. If you look what Microsoft Teams is doing.
Yeah.
If you talk with young people, not us, yeah, then if you ask, hey, where is this file? They're not saying in this folder. They say it's in this chat.
And that, it's interesting because even as an older person, I exist a little more sometimes in the Apple world, and you know, there's a lot of these features that they've added recently around like file sharing in iMessage and stuff. And a lot of older people's like, you collaborate on a file in a chat program. That doesn't make sense. But it's not aimed at us.
Exactly. Yeah.
But do you mean, you know, on that though, you know, one thing that some of the commercial tools do to varying degrees of success, sometimes not as much as you may expect, but is that the integration between the components.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, when you are somewhat existent, dependent on third-party developers to contribute aspects that may be fundamental parts of people's workflows, how do you go around ensuring that there is that ability for the information to pass between the components?
That's a good question. So, I mean, that integration is something we really focus a lot on. I think this is our strongest point at Nextcloud, actually, that you have your, I don't know, you see, if you create a calendar invite, you immediately can say, also create like a chat and video call room and link it together. And then if you go into the chat room, you can see already, when is the next call happening, because it's reading the data from the calendar. And if you upload a file into a chat, of course, it's also then in the file system too, and an attachment to a project management to do is also there. So it's heavily integrated. But your question was how to make sure that this always happens.
Make it easier, I suppose. You can provide SDKs and API. It doesn't mean people use them, but you kind of hope they will.
Yeah.
It's always, you know, even in something like Google Docs, you know, the ability you create like an app task for someone,
mm-hmm.
and then finding that again is always like. Some places things integrate better than others, and it's always a challenge because often it's different teams working on things.
Right.
So in a kind of more open platform, it's even harder.
Because
people will tend to like, I like this thing, I like this, but it exists somewhat in isolation to this thing over here. So
yeah,
but in a collaboration platform, you kind of want that.
It can be a challenge. I mean, we have a good search, right? We have also an activity list where you have a chronological thing where you can see everything that happened, but I agree it can be sometimes tricky to find things again. And lately someone mentioned that there are like 5 different ways for tracking to-dos in Nextcloud. that's a problem, to be honest.
I don't like that,
and we have to see if we can unify this again. But yeah, it can be a challenge. There's so many features, so it can be, you can lose things.
Yeah. So the other question, like I remember when I kind of just stopped using Nextcloud because I didn't really have any need for it anymore. And I switched from a Raspberry Pi to an Intel machine. It was just an opportunity to be like a fresh start. I actually more needed a machine to test Kubernetes and things on than like a collaboration server. I didn't really need it anymore for various reasons.
Sure.
You know, a Raspberry Pi is a fairly constrained environment and it could still work fairly well. I sort of wonder how you manage to maintain and allow for a tool that can do a lot, but can also run in a constrained environment. Mm-hmm. And how do you have some kind of like graceful, what's the word? They use it in the web world a lot. You know, the ability to sort of fall back to lesser functionality when running on lower spec machines and things.
Exactly. This is actually one of the design goals of Nextcloud, that it can run on really small devices. And then also scales to millions of users. Mm-hmm. And this is it's an aspect that's not really discussed a lot about Nextcloud, but it's something I'm a little bit proud of, that it's like software that runs from very small to very big. And we care about that. For example, there is, if you think about the video conferencing thing, Nextcloud Talk that is built in, if you just install not even a Docker container, just the zip file with the PHP file. So just unzip it on a Raspberry Pi, it immediately works.
Okay.
And you can immediately do video calls. But this is like a simple setup. So all the communication is going through long polling, for example. This is basically not a proper WebSocket because it does not exist. And you also the video streams are distributed peer-to-peer between the attendees, which does not really scale. So this is then a setup where you can do, like, I don't know, calls between 3-4 people. And it's also shown in the web interface, hey, by the way, this only works for 3-4 people. But then you can install an additional component. We call this the high-performance backend. This actually comes with a Go component, which does proper WebSockets. And this then also a component that collects video streams and distributes them to everybody. And with this component, you can really do it with hundreds of people in a call. But this is then, as you said, this is like an additional thing that you need to run, you need to install, to update. And in return, you get better performance.
Yeah. This is interesting because I must admit, like, I never really know where to direct people sometimes for video calls. I sometimes settle on Google Meet just because it's easy and it's free to a point, but I don't really always like it. And you're always looking for other options. Mm. You know, in theory, you could self-host your own like video call platform quite easily, I guess. Yeah. Sort of maintaining the state in between. If it was on your own machine, I'm not sure how that would work exactly. But now I'm kind of intrigued. Even doing like remote recordings, you know, I pay for software that does this. So I'm kind of like, well, if I can host my own video call, surely I can then just like FFmpeg the recording and stuff like that. And
we have call recording built in.
But what kind of quality?
The recording has no quality problems.
Is it uncompressed? Give you uncompressed? Or?
No, I mean, it records what goes through WebRTC.
Okay. Yeah, and this is always the issue with a lot of these.
Yeah.
Because a lot of the commercial tools, they record locally. And this is where you start paying because...
Ah, that's what you mean. Basically, you can record your own stuff locally.
But then it will record their end locally as well upload into... Yeah.
This is not a feature we have.
Yeah. I mean, not that podcasters is a huge market. There's a handful of tools that do this. There's all the others, like Video Ninja.
Mm-hmm.
It's all WebRTC, which is still... It's inconsistent with its quality, unfortunately. Yeah, but live recording on someone's machine and then uploading and stuff is fairly intensive.
Yeah, yeah.
But always would be wonderful to stop paying for the ones they're currently using.
Right.
Cheap, which probably says a lot of how expensive they are to run. Maybe.
Yeah.
Future feature. Just finally, because you also mentioned the AI thing, and my memory of what you had last year was the rating of models. Is this to sort of run them on? Yep. So what's the intention of that? Run on instance and do what exactly?
So that's, I mean, with AI, the thing is that there's some challenges, there's some compromises, because on one hand, you want to have the good performance, the quick answers. This needs a lot of resources.
Yeah,
you can have them. Everything we do runs local. You can run them locally, but then you need like a good GPU in your server, which not everybody has. And then there's also the option to use other services. I mean, you can use the OpenAI and the Google services if you want, but then they have all your data.
Yeah,
maybe not what you want. But there are other companies, for example, it's UVH in France or IONOS in Germany. They have basically LLM as a service. And we have the APIs integrated and you can switch them on.
Okay.
And then they can do the processing if you don't really want to host it yourself.
Yeah. And of course, there's a whole other issue of, I'm sure there's been dozens of talks on the topic of like how open is some open AI is anyway. Not always.
But OpenAI are the most closed one.
Yeah.
The open name.
And can you also then run those on like your data in the Nextcloud instance as well to have like a, you know, the classic now, ironically, assistive interaction with your files?
You can do that. And maybe also to explain why this is useful. You might think that I have a chatbot somewhere else, why this need to be Nextcloud. The thing is, the cool thing is you can interact with your data.
Yep.
So we can ask, hey, where do I meet for lunch next week, blah, 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 and then can go through all my mails, my calendar, whatever, and gives you an answer. So this is quite cool. And with the next version, we also have support for tooling for agents. So you can also tell the chatbot, hey, can you please arrange a meeting with this guy next Monday when the sun is shining, but not at 2:00. And then it does it, sends mails, creates invites and everything. So that's, I think it's quite cool, actually.
You're laughing.
No, it's more like generally apart from this current weekend, it's like that's impossible until April.
Exactly.
And apart from that, what's next?
What's next? Oh, I don't know. Keep on providing privacy-friendly alternatives to big tech companies, which is a big job, I have to say.
Yeah, yeah, I think it's going to become a bigger job now as well.
And but we see now with the latest changes in the world how, I don't know, might can be Trump or China or Russia or whatever, it shows that how important it is to know where your data is, who has control, who can switch it off, not switch it off. And this is a solution that we want to provide, Nextcloud, and working on it.
I feel like to a lot of the audience this goes out to, they will know all these things, but I think it's always worth just recapping. What is Mastodon?
Mastodon is, well, the tagline is where conversations happen. It is a open source, non-VC funded, donation funded, decentralized social network.
What does decentralized mean?
That's an excellent question, because the first thing that one person came and asked us about today was blockchain. It is not.
I used to work in that space as well. And interestingly, actually, this FOSDEM, I've heard a lot of people saying, we're making a decentralized protocol. And my first question has been, oh, is it a blockchain? They've said no. So there seems to be a Web 4.0. I don't know.
Yeah. So in this context, decentralized means that there are many different servers. There is no one centralized server that everybody connects to and everybody has an account on. There are many distributed instances, we call them, or servers of Mastodon. You can join anyone that you choose that has rules and culture of your preference and that will accept you joining them. And you can talk to anybody in the network. It's a federated network. It uses a technology called ActivityPub, which is a W3C standard,
is it?
Under the covers. It uses some other open W3C and other IETF protocols that, you know, HTTP, TCP/IP, Webfinger, all of those kind of things that are in there to do the discovery of actors, people. People have inboxes. This is all kind of at the technical level where messages get published to across the network. And that's how your feed is built up. There is no algorithm. So unlike other centralized social networks, there's no central system that is determining what you see. It is purely the arrival of messages in a timeline, a time-based order. So there's nothing to interfere with the sequence in which you're going to see things.
Except any rules on the instance, I suppose.
So there might be rules on the instance that block certain other instances. Yeah. That would be one of those. You can choose to mute other people. Yeah. I use a couple of third-party apps that I connect my Mastodon account to that will do things like determining what are the most liked posts that I might have missed in the last 24 hours. Because unless the problem with a time-based user interface is unless you're there at the time that it's posted, you're going to miss it. So there's a couple of apps that I use that will send me either a daily summary of hot ones, i.e. the most posted or most liked or boosted, or things that match certain topics I'm interested in, things like that.
And what came first, ActivityPub or Mastodon?
Mastodon.
Okay. So Mastodon
started, I believe, in 2016, and it was using something called OStatus, which was also a similar sort of protocol. It was used by another platform called Identica. And in 2018, Eugene, who created Mastodon, pivoted into also supporting ActivityPub. And for a while, that existed with OStatus, and now it's just ActivityPub.
What was ActivityPub being used or before that?
It was more or less a newish standard from the W3C at the time. It's based on a JSON format called Activity Streams.
Okay.
And ActivityPub sort of adds, as well as the data format that Activity Streams gives you, which is activities, like an event or a post or an article or a note specifically, things like that. Then it also then adds the ability for you to publish those out to different inboxes.
Okay. And I do believe, and now I can ask a potential insider, I was writing about Ruby's 30th birthday last year, and I was at Heroku in Sarajevo, and I do believe, they claimed anyway, it's one of the biggest Rails apps. We're using Rails and Wasm, I think.
We use Ruby and Ruby on Rails. Yeah. I spoke at Ruby World in Japan in December. I was very honored to be there. I can't tell you where it is on the scale of Ruby apps. It's very highly deployed. There are tens of thousands of instances of software built on Ruby and Rails, Mastodon, running in the world, which has got to be a pretty big deployment, I would say. We upgraded in the last release to the most recent at the time, Ruby, which I think was 3.3. I think 3.4 just dropped in December. I am not a Rubyist, so I'm trying to keep
up. Neither am I, actually. So it just was in my mind. I was like, well, I should ask.
I'm pretty sure. I mean, that's another reason why we were invited to speak at Ruby World. I think they'd been quite keen for somebody from the team to go and speak there for a while.
It's
great. It's interesting for me. My background a long time ago, 10 or 11 years ago, I started working on a project called Cloud Foundry, which was at the time a VMware project, but that was originally written in Ruby. They ended up migrating to Go, but I spent a couple of years in that Ruby community then, and then I kind of went away from it to do other things and have ended up coming back to it a bit.
So. I was having a chat with the guy who maintains Homebrew earlier. I interviewed him last year, and one of the questions I asked him was, would you rewrite now? Because it's all in Ruby. Yeah. It's kind of like, well, it's not really worth it anymore. Mm. But you know, you can sort of sometimes spot when projects were created by what they're written. You know?
I guess that's a fairly true, isn't it? Yeah, I know Mike from Brew is awesome. And I know, because I spoke to the team that does the Ruby code development before I went to Ruby World, and they do really appreciate its flexibility, its convenience, and it seems to be something that they enjoy writing. Yeah. So.
Now on that, the reason I reached out to you is I heard you on another podcast. And ironically, this is where things get weird. That same podcast on an interview with the Homebrew guy mentioned one of my, so it's sort of gone back and forth, you know, it's a small world, that you only work for the Mastodon Foundation or something like that?
Before we just back up a little bit. So right now, Mastodon is it's a German-based corporation, GmbH, which is a tax exempt, I believe. I'm not a tax expert.
GmbH. Okay, okay.
So I apologize. My knowledge of German business structures is very limited. I believe that the lowercase g was removed at some point in the last 12 months for reasons. And so that I work for that organization one day a week at the moment on a freelance basis. Yeah. Yeah. What have we have just announced, you mentioned a foundation. There is an organization that we're forming. So we've announced about 2 weeks ago as we record this, that we are going to form a new European-based nonprofit to own the trademark copyrights, run the software project.
Yeah.
Because right now the organization runs two instances of Mastodon, running Mastodon.social, Mastodon Online. So it runs a bit of infrastructure there. It also builds the software and manages a few other bits and pieces.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we want to sort of make sure that that's clearly separated. We also want to remove the individual ownership of the assets.
Yeah, for sure.
Right?
Yeah.
So we've seen with some other projects, there's either been a movement for or against that process. And we want to make clear that Mastodon is, as a community, is bigger than one person. It's more important than one person.
Yeah.
And it's something that we want to be sustainable.
Yeah.
So that's what we're in the process of doing. And hopefully, I may end up working for whatever that new nonprofit is.
I've actually spoken to one presentation, spoken to the Rust Foundation.
Yeah.
CEO, I'm not sure. President.
Rebecca.
Yeah. Where it seems to be a few of the slightly more recent but massively growing projects have done this very recently. You know, the separating, in Rust's case, more of a company owner, but. And then there was also a talk from someone from ASCII.org. They're doing something similar.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I don't know if it's some kind of legal reasons. You know, there's some new regulations in Europe that have changed how open source projects have to represent themselves because of culpability and stuff like that. I don't know if it had anything to do with that, which is coincidence. But
I'm not a lawyer either.
I'm just wondering.
But I think you're right to sort of point out that there have been EU regulatory changes and... I've been formally involved with organizations as a contributor, like the Eclipse Foundation.
Yeah.
You've become one of the stewards of sort of open source software under the European CRA, the new regulation. It's definitely an advantage to form something that takes away that liability from individual maintainers.
Yeah.
As I understand it, as a bystander, non-legal bystander,
bystander.
And contributor, I definitely don't want to be under those kind of spotlights as an individual.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think it's also something that helps to demonstrate. It doesn't help to demonstrate. I think it's just a signal of the maturity of the people that are involved in the movements that are involved in building these things. And recognition, if you want to sustain, that actually it's very difficult to do that as a one or two person organization.
I want to come back to that in a second because we sort of jumped over.
Okay.
So you're doing one day a week for Mastodon.
Yes.
The quote marks.
Yeah, you'll find that in our transparency report, annual report that we came
doing
out.
Doing what exactly? We should probably actually clarify that.
Okay, yeah, absolutely. So my role and my background has been in a role called developer relations for about 15 years now in different companies. Developer relations covers a lot of different things. It can cover public speaking, kind of going and evangelizing something. It can cover writing blog posts, writing documentation. It can cover individually, you know, dealing with support tickets.
Yeah.
I tend towards the storytelling side of things, helping to
one day a week, isn't it?
Well, you know, there's an element of that that the organization's a nonprofit. You know, I am somewhat expensive to pay a sustainable wage to, which I recognize. And, you know, there's the balancing of resources for the project, and I appreciate the opportunity. So what I have been doing for Mastodon for the last about 2 years now is helping with a number of things like documentation, things like the first thing I did was go through our list of third-party libraries and third-party clients on our website and make sure that that was all up to date. Those people that wrote that are recognized, that we recognize them and say, look, thank you. Because in my experience, if you are willing to take an API that someone stood up and write a high quality wrapper for it in a language of your choosing that you know really well, that the owner of the API may not know really well, you then become the support person for that language's community, right?
Yep.
So there's a great library called mastodon.py for Python, and Halsey, the person that built that, is a fantastic advocate for Mastodon.
Yeah.
You know, we've never done anything to create that. He's just gone and done it, and people ask him questions about the Mastodon API. People who, for me, whichever platform I've ever worked at where there's been an API, the people that build that intermediate layer are heroes.
Yeah.
So I wanted to make sure that they were recognized. As well as that, I got background with lots of other organizations, so I've been making connections with them. Mastodon is one part of what we call the Fediverse.
Yes.
So this interconnected series of networks that's based on ActivityPub.
Yeah.
So what I wanted to also make, what I've tried to also ensure in the last 2 years is that we've kept talking to the other projects, that we've given them channels to connect with us, to ask questions about changes we're making.
So I'm assuming Mastodon is probably the biggest kind of, I would consumer of, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, I would say that it's probably the largest open source implementer of the ActivityPub standard today.
I know
there are other ones coming along. Yes, so the reason I couched it like that is that, for example, Meta have stood up this thing called Threads. Threads has added some support for the network.
Okay.
It's not fully bi-directional.
Yeah.
So at the moment you can find Fediverse users and see them in a separate tab in Threads. It's not very integrated.
No.
You can't reply to people from inside of Threads. So it's a great way for them to get more, their users to get more visibility of other stuff if you want.
Yeah.
But so if you were to take it purely on numbers, Threads has however many tens of millions of users, and Mastodon has a smaller number than that. But I think Mastodon is probably one of the larger full-scale implementations with ActivityPub today. But we've also got WordPress as a plugin for ActivityPub. So if you've got a WordPress blog, you install that plugin. Yeah. And then, of course, there are millions of WordPress blogs. It runs whatever percentages of the internet, of the web, I should say. You have the opportunity to join that network.
Yeah.
And Ghost. John O'Nolan was speaking about Ghost on the social web track at FOSDEM yesterday. Yeah. They've got a beta coming in March for their version 6, which will include ActivityPub support, which is a great opportunity for creators on Ghost to join that network.
I was in Glasgow a couple of years ago as well, and I went to a kind of hacker meetup, and they were talking about Glasgow.social as well.
Yeah. It's
like an ActivityPub kind of social thing for finding events
Mastodon,
and stuff.
I believe.
I think it was something, it was a web.
Go to social, maybe. I can't
something
remember.
Else. Yeah. I can't remember. And I've had it bookmarked for ages because I wasn't back in Glasgow.
Right.
I just hadn't really looked at it.
But
it was kind of, this is when I realized that there are other ActivityPub things.
Yes.
And this kind of decentralized web, independent web, aggregated web, federated web, whatever you want to call it, the dream has been around for a while, never in and out of realization. And it's sort of one of those things that every now and then I get excited by it again, and then it doesn't quite get there. And
then you find somebody to interview about, and then you go off again.
No. Just in terms of that, it sort of feels like a combination of technology and external factors. Of maybe now is the right time. I don't know. We'll see, I suppose. Yeah.
I think there's a growing realization with political change in the world that owning your own data, having different sources of backup data, like as we record this, there's a lot of panic as certain data is deleted from websites in the US and government websites in the US and other organizations like the Internet Archive and others are trying to prevent that. And I think that's tremendously important. My degree's in history. Yeah. And I see this whole thing as a continuum, and the continuum is bound up by humans and society. Right? Yeah. Technology is a tool.
Yeah.
Humans continue to use things in different ways, good and bad. And I think you're right. There are waves of moments of realization that, oh, actually, this is important. And we should be taking ownership of our stuff more seriously than giving it up to someone else.
Yeah.
The problem with humans is that we are tremendously lazy species, right?
Yeah. So
it's the same reason that I need to stop using the X for or X versus Y, you know.
Coming very quickly back to Mastodon, because I recently wrote a piece about something else about Ladybird. I don't
know. Yes, the browser.
Yeah. And I was doing some kind of comparisons of, you know, the free open versions of things versus the not.
Yeah.
And something that's always concerned me with projects like Mastodon and Signal, probably the other one that's comparable, that are dependent mostly on donations. As you unfortunately rightly said, a lot of people are lazy and don't donate to things. So kind of as the project scales, how do you maintain reliability and authenticity successfully on probably a relatively small budget compared to that scale?
It's an excellent question, and it's obviously one that we think a lot about. We've made a choice. Eugene, who founded it, has made a choice not to take massive VC funding because we want to stay on a path of authenticity, not needing to sell user data, letting people choose their experience. But that does mean that we are limited in terms of resources.
Wow.
Last year, we created a 501c3 organization in the US, which makes it more tax efficient, basically for people in the US to make donations, which has helped us a bit. I hope with our new organization structure in the EU that will make things a bit easier and more efficient here. I don't know yet. To the point of individuals making donations, I think, of course, it's not just laziness, it's also their own resources, right? So I think where people recognize value in something, then typically they may choose to donate. We need to make that easy for people. I think with platforms, technology platforms that then want to cut of the payment, that makes things a bit more
easier to make donations, etc.
Easier to make donations. So I think there are platforms that want to cut those donations, and that gets in the way of those platforms. I don't know how it all shakes out. I'm hoping that some larger organizations will be able to help and support as well. I think there are
I was wondering that actually, like how much of it is individuals versus
You
know, when you talk about Rust, for example, it tends to be probably a small amount of large donations and a handful of smaller, but I wonder if it's something like Mastodon, it may be more.
It's a bit more difficult to demonstrate a value, let's say, right? So Rust, you're writing software to run on hardware and it's memory safe, and the companies that use it are going to donate some to contribute to its progress. And with a social network, it might be more difficult to demonstrate that.
In some respects, not that it's a business play because you don't want to do that, but have you seen any instances of a business using a Mastodon instance as if you remember Yabba, things like that, like they're an internal kind of social network for a company or something?
We haven't seen that. What we have seen is some large organizations, the EU, European Union, for one of them, who have set up their own instance. In the case of the European Union, that's something that the Mastodon organization maintains for them, runs for them.
Oh, really?
So we have an arrangement with them to help them to do that. And I think I wrote some blog posts last year called around what I phrased Fediverse for Freedom, really encouraging more public institutions to take the step of owning their own voice online, owning their own channel to the public that can't be cut off by someone else at any time. And I think that that's an opportunity. I think if we were to think about opportunities to make a business around Mastodon, we've also got people that are running hosting services for
it's fairly resource intensive, I think, isn't it?
I believe it's got better with the later, the newer versions of Ruby. I think the efficiency and so on got a lot better. I don't remember the specific numbers and percentages, but I spoke about them in Japan in my Ruby World talk. It's a Ruby stack. It's got Postgres. It's got Redis.
It also depends on how many users.
It does depend on how many users you've got. And if you've got users that have a very large following because of the way that the protocol works, they may add a bit more strain or volume to the server. But I can't speak directly to how resource intensive.
I just wondered. I've sort of heard this, like people who've tried to run it and it can be relatively expensive. Then is that sort of interesting model, because the Mastodon itself as a business, a foundation, a charity needs contributions, but then some people who also run instances also have their own
kind of, and that's another thing. So I do not run, have my account on the main Mastodon instance owned by Mastodon, the organization. I have it on another one, and I give that person $20 a month because I know that person, I like my instance, I like the community that they're. And I also donate to the main Mastodon project, and I work for the main Mastodon. Bit of a circular thing there, but anyway.
Paying your own wages.
Well, maybe, but you know, again, I believe in these things.
Yeah.
But one thing I think we can do as a project is, and this comes up has come up before, is make it easier for users to donate to the part that they care about,
or
ideally both, but you know, whether they contribute to the ongoing maintenance of the software, whether they contribute, make it easy to donate to the owner of the instance. Some of the instance owners, have a Patreon or Open Collective or whatever they might have. There's a couple of ones that are actually full cooperatives and have their own governance structure where everybody on the instance gets a governing vote. So it's actually shows a lot of interesting social models and movements and opportunities.
Does the platform allow for that, or do they use external kind of tools?
Yeah, I think they use external tools. Mm-hmm. I can't be sure exactly how, for example. So the one I'm thinking of is called social.coop in the US, and they're a cooperative, and I can't specifically comment on how they operate. I know that they've got some smart people that are running it, but I don't know how they organize their voting and those kind of things. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there's nothing specific in the platform, in Mastodon itself.
So what's, I don't really, I sort of don't entirely know if Mastodon has kind of like feature roadmaps and things.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm not 100%, you know, it's like, unless you want to keep up with the big commercial things, like how much more do you need to add? But what's coming up?
well, to that point, just to take that point, first of all, I think up to now, and I don't think this is changing immediately, Mastodon's made a choice about what it is and what it isn't, right? We don't need to add online shopping and video live streaming and lots of other things to it. It knows what it is. Now, if you were to say, I'm coming from a platform and I'm coming to Mastodon and I therefore want all the features that other platform has, you may not find them, because it's a short form, generally speaking, short form text based sharing system where you can add a few videos, pictures or a video if you want, not everything, right? So personally, I'm happy with that. We do have people asking for additional features like reactions instead of just likes.
Yeah.
Don't think that's going to come to Mastodon anytime soon. Things that we've said we are going to be working on, we need to add some better safety features.
Okay.
So better tools for moderators.
Yep.
Quote posts is one thing that
people
firmly believe is not coming, because at some point Eugene said he did not think they were a good idea. And times have changed. And, we're looking at ways to enable that we can add to the standard that everybody uses or agree with the Fediverse community is a way of doing it, so that you, as a user, can choose not to have your posts quoted. For example, now that's problematic, because in principle anybody can take a screenshot and share it anyway. But adding friction and putting a way in place for you as a user to have some agency over how your content is
used.
Make
it less easy.
So we're doing that. We're working on that at the moment. We've got a few other things. There's a project that is funded by the EU Next Generation Internet Search Project, which is called Fediverse Discovery Providers.
Mm-hmm.
They have provided funding for our developer for that. So that is building a search add-on to any Fediverse platform. It doesn't have to be Mastodon. It's coming from Mastodon. And we hope everyone in the Fediverse can benefit. And what that will enable is, at the moment, the maximum breadth of search on Mastodon is your instance, right? So it will know about, you can if you say, my posts are available for search on my instance, that's fine, but it's not going to be necessarily visible to other instances. What this will enable is for your instance to opt into a broader pool of discovery. So that might enable things like finding musicians on a music platform, making things more visible in different ways. So that's something coming.
It starts to become a little bit like the all-in-one platform, but in a different kind of way.
I would argue that it's about discovery and going to find that elsewhere than about trying to host it all in one place and shove it all into one.
Okay,
One thing that very frequently comes up and has come up in conversations at Fosdem is direct messages or private messages or encrypted messages.
Yeah.
And Mastodon has a feature where you can send a message in quotes privately.
I know,
so
it's I always forget how to use it. Hence how conversation was very
right. And it's different to other platforms.
Yeah.
And that might be alarming to some people if they forget how that works. It's not a private messaging platform. It doesn't have end-to-end encryption. Some of those other platforms don't have that either. But there are really good options like Matrix and Signal where you can have those things. And, you know, personally, I grew up with the Unix philosophy of, you know, do one thing well and then, you know, plug into other things that do one thing well. I don't think, I'm not trying to ascribe that to Mastodon, but I think that we do know what we are and where we're going with things. I think we can do a lot more around usability, making it visually and appealing and things like that. So roadmap, quote posts, a bit of a UI tune-up, some better discovery features and definitely better safety features. Those are the kind of top priorities.
A final question, which you don't have to answer if you don't want to. I mean, you say you're doing this one day a week. And I don't know how, unless that day is a very long day. I don't entirely understand how you're doing this. What do you do the rest of the time?
So to be totally transparent, I was laid off from a previous role at a company called Twitter that no longer exists by a man that paid far too much money for it. So I had an opportunity to do something different for a while. So I have been very much living on those savings for a while, to be honest with you. What I do, I describe myself as a freelance technologist. Okay. I have an art studio in West London with my wife, where we use pen plotters and drawing machines and 3D printers to create art.
Oh, I think I saw that on your... We're going to be back in London in March. So maybe I'll call you again.
Yeah, absolutely.
Come take a look.
Happy to have a chat. So that was something that I started doing accidentally after my previous experience. And I got the opportunity to work with the Mastodon team. And I contribute to lots of open source projects. I'm a drive-by pull request sender. You know,
mostly on documentation for me. But
yeah.
Which you endlessly find errors on.
I love that, right? The opportunity to help those projects to polish their experience for other users. I'm very much in that same area, you know. Mm-hmm. I don't know every programming language in the world. I dabble in lots of them.
Yeah.
But things like user experience, documentation, screenshots, that kind of thing, making sure it's clear to people to help them learn from the mistakes you've made is something that we can all do to improve. And it's the same with anything like Wikipedia, anything that's collaborative that has a cultural relevance. I think we can all... I grew up with a mindset of giving back. And helping to improve things, and that's what I've tried to do across my life, I think.
Awesome. That was a nice spot to end.
So that was it. That was our guest today. Thank you very much for joining me in the Tech Lounge. I have been Christian Schiller. If you want to know more about Tech Lounge, head on over to christianschiller.com or please tell your friends about us. It's quiet and cozy in here, but the more listeners, the merrier. You can find more at christianschiller.com/podcast or in the show notes or episode notes, wherever you found this podcast. Thank you very much for joining me, and you're most welcome next time.